Okay, let's switch over to the art of persuasion for this session. And I think we finished section two, didn't we? Is that correct? So we want to look at this idea of persuade, to persuade or not persuade. Some people are repelled by the idea of persuasion because it smacks of salesmanship and manipulation. Now, I don't know if that's true here. Maybe you guys can give me some feedback, but just the whole idea of persuasion in an American context has kind of a negative connotation. Like, you're trying to get me to think something I don't want to think or to do something I don't want to do. Does it have that same concept here? Yes? No?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that's what I'm thinking. So we want to examine this. We call this the art of persuasion, but is persuasion even something that we should try to do? And that's why we call it to persuade or not to persuade. So most people who are opposed to persuading for preachers, they use this verse. Let's read it. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith may not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. Now, if we're just looking at that verse, what does it appear that Paul's view about persuasion is? Class, what's his view?
Not important.
Not important? Yeah, what else? Huh? JR? What's that? It does look like he's anti-persuasion, doesn't he? He said, I didn't do that deliberately, but I came with a demonstration of the Spirit's power. So it sets up kind of a false dichotomy that anyone who's trying to persuade is obviously not trusting in the Spirit's power. So based on this verse, number two, it seems that Paul does not use any of the methods of persuasion. And when we talk about methods of persuasion, we're talking about audience analysis, focus on need, cultural analysis. None of those things Paul says he does. He just preaches with power. Now, the problem we have here is if we just isolate this verse without looking at Paul's other verses about this topic, then I think we're going to make a mistake. So what we find in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 is the very thing Paul previously said he never does, now he's telling us he tries hard to do. Since then we know what it is to fear the Lord. We try to persuade men. Now wait a minute, Paul. In the first letter to Corinthians, you said, we never persuade. Second letter, we try to persuade. Are you confused? Are you double-minded? Or did you change your mind? Did you forget what you wrote? What is happening here? Number three, a brief examination of the book of Acts shows that Paul did a lot of persuading. Notice this, 13:14. Now when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. Acts 18, and he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. Acts 19, he entered the synagogue and continued speaking out boldly for 3 months, reasoning and persuading them about the kingdom of God. Acts 28, so when they had appointed a day, many came to him at his lodging, to whom he explained and solemnly testified of the kingdom of God, persuading them concerning Jesus from both the law of Moses and the prophets from morning till evening. So how do we interpret this 1 Corinthians passage? What was Paul's view of persuasion, and therefore what should our view of persuasion be? Well, number four, it's important to realize there are two kinds of persuasion. Two kinds of persuasion. One is scriptural and one isn't. Yeah. So one is scriptural and one isn't. There's a certain kind of persuasion, and I think this is the persuasion Paul refers to in 1 Corinthians, a certain kind of persuasion that is an insincere manipulation, a coercion designed to influence someone for your own goals or for your own ends. Now you see in that 1 Corinthians passage, Paul used the word eloquence. Did you notice that? I think I bolded it. He used that. Now when he uses that word, he's referring to a particular meaning it had in the Greek culture in the first century. It meant playing to a crowd or doing things to get an applause. And that's what Paul says he didn't do. He's making a reference to a group that was very prominent in first century Greek culture called the Sophists. Sophists. You heard that term before? S-O-P-H-I-S-T, the Sophists. Anyone? The Sophists. It comes from a Greek word, the Greek word Sophia, which means what? Wisdom. Right, yeah. Sophia is wisdom. That's why, do you use the term here for your second year at university? You're called a what? Sophomore. Now, that comes from, there's two Greek words there in sophomore. The first one, Sophia, which means, or wise, and the second one, what does that mean? Anybody? Well, we have an English word that comes from the Greek word. It's moron. Do you know that word? Moron. So the word sophomore literally means a wise fool. Yeah, wise moron. You know why sophomores are called that? Well, they're wise because they're not as stupid as freshmen. But they're fools because they think they know something because they've had 1 year, but they're really, they don't know anything. So their sophomore is a wise fool or a smart moron. Yeah, I thought you'd appreciate that. Well, this is our second class. So I guess you guys are sophomores. So. Now, the Sophists in the first century were traveling teachers who trained students for public and political life. And they charged a huge fee for it. And they primarily trained them in the art of rhetoric. Do you know what rhetoric is? Rhetoric is the art of public communication, public speaking. The word rhetoric, even in our English language, has a negative connotation. When you use the word rhetoric in an English sentence, in an English setting, it usually is negative. So you something that said, yeah, we had to listen to him and all his rhetoric. That means just his fancy word smithing, word crafting, trying to make something sound so eloquent, but he was just covering up. So a politician, maybe, would be a rhetorician, someone who knows how to use elegant speech to say nothing or to lie in such a way that it sounds very good. And that's what the Sophists, that's what they train people to do. They train people. They were not concerned about the truth. They didn't really even believe in the concept of truth. What they were concerned with is how to teach you to present your argument in a way to get what you wanted. To persuade people to come on your side and to get what you wanted. So it was very possible that Paul could be confused for a sophist. You see, think about what he's doing, right? He's a traveling teacher. He is training people for ministry and public life. He's speaking in public. And when he goes to Corinth, this Greek headquarters of this kind of rhetoric, this kind of sophistry, these teachers, he wants to make it clear and distance himself from that kind of persuasion. You see what he's saying? I don't do that kind of persuasion. As a matter of fact, in number 5, I think, on your notes, Paul describes the kind of persuasion he did in 1 Thessalonians. Now listen to it. And this is directly trying to distance himself from the sophist. For our exhortation, our preaching, doesn't come from error or impurity or by way of deceit, like the sophist. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. Matter of fact, one of the reasons Paul, in some situations, refused to receive an offering and instead worked and paid his own way is to make sure that he was not classed as one of these sophists who are just preaching for money, just trying to get the big offering, trying to get the big fee, trying to get rich just with his mouth. So do you see what's happening here? So that kind of persuasion we don't do. However, it's obvious that we are to persuade people in a godly, biblical way. And so number 6, Paul's style of persuasion then was to lead someone by reason and entreaty to believe or to do something for the glory of God. It was to influence, win over, or bring about a change of mind by the influence of reason or moral considerations. That's what we're supposed to do. So we're supposed to persuade, not just using flattering speech, but how do we arrange our material in such a way as to convince people the truth? We're trying to persuade them. And one thing that you notice, when you see Paul's preaching and persuading, you see this other word that's often paired with it, and it's reasoning. Now, I think we ought to talk about this among ourselves for a little bit. My experience in general, and I think this is across the board with charismatic preaching, I think maybe it seems to be a little bit more prominent here. And that's just my perspective, could be wrong. We tend to do very little reasoning. We try to persuade through emotions. That's at least my perspective. Give me some pushback and tell me, no, it's not that way. But that's kind of how I've seen. Filipinos are, it seems to be, more moved by an emotional argument. And so that's why humor is so prominent, right? We make them laugh, we get them laughing, we get their emotions involved, and we persuade them emotionally. The idea of thinking about A plus B equals C, reason, a rational argument, doesn't seem to be as prominent among us. Class, respond to that. Accurate, inaccurate, partially accurate? Never thought about it before? Thoughts? Yeah, Alfred.
You know, when I think the emotion, you're talking about the emotion, you're saying observation is...
That's my observation, yeah.
Filipinos are more into responding more into emotion.
Let me say this way. People make decisions out of several different things. Sometimes they're just swayed emotionally.
Yeah. But isn't it very universal?
It is, yeah.
Because, you know, when you look at sales, that's what you do. you really stir up emotions more than the reasons.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, marketing, that's that everywhere.
Sure, yeah.
And I think also even in our teaching, I think that I remember when we were doing Christ-centered preaching, there were some Greek words that we use, chronos, ethos, and there's another word.
Pathos.
So, and it's also talked about the emotion.
Yeah, right.
That you already have to appeal.
All three of them were in there, though.
Yeah, you have to appeal to the emotion before they could make the decision. So, so I think it's only right.
But now, Alpha, that's good because you brought up that Greek model. But in that Greek model is logos.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is not the word, but it's reasoning.
Yeah, reasoning. Yeah, but again, even that.
But it's a package.
Yes.
So I'm not saying that emotion isn't good.
Okay.
So if you just make a decision based on reason, it's often not a... It often won't be as effective. It won't last as long.
But also you said earlier that there are times that we have to do motion, you know, so that emotion will follow. And that you were saying that earlier, like when we, you know, we talked about loving.
Andrew said that. Yeah,
Andrew says that.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, you know, I'm just.
No, great. No, we're just talking and having pushback. So you can make decisions based on pure emotion or pure reason. And usually neither one of them work out very well. So let's just talk about a person that falls in love. Love. Pure emotion and makes a purely emotional decision. Let's elope and get married. Well, just a whirlwind romance. Do you have that term?
Yeah.
Just emotion. Woo, just caught up. It's just, woo, let's just go do it. Rarely do those work out, right? But on the other hand, there's a completely rational decision. I had the misfortune of being at visiting a church. This was in the Maranatha days, and it was a bachelor party for a particular guy that was getting married that next week. And he's talking about the girl and talking about how this whole process happened. And some of you remember, how many of you were actually in Maranatha when we were? You're the only one that goes back to the Maranatha days here, huh? Okay, a couple. Yeah.
I almost said that.
So we had this thing called God's Perfect Choice, right? Yeah, right. Yeah, well, so this was back in those days, right? Okay. So I'm listening to his testimony. It's all about the Lord spoke to me, the Lord told me, the Lord wants me, the Lord is directing me. I didn't hear what I think a week before you ought to hear. Like, woo! I can't wait. I'm wanting a little bit of passion, and all I'm hearing is just, this is what God said, Lordship, I'm doing it because he said, carry the cross. Yeah, I think it actually came up. So we went for a walk afterwards, and I was just curious. Me and the guy, the groom, we went for a walk. I said, so I was curious, you know, and I didn't hear much about this. And I'm like, how do you feel about this girl? And the Lord spoke to you. Yeah, I know. He spoke to you. Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. Lordship, I'm disciple, make, yes. How do you feel about her? And I couldn't get him to answer the question. I said, if God hadn't told you, do you want to marry this girl? No. No. Just total reason, see? No emotion. And he made a decision. I said, I'm not sure that's going to be the best thing for you. I said, I would think that if God really was in this, that you would be passionate about it yourself. Right? Are y'all with me? And so he broke off the engagement. You know, thank God he did. Now, the girl was, You know, she was not happy because she really loved him. And, of course, you know, it was embarrassing. And the parents, you know how it works in the States, right? The parents of the bride pay for the wedding. And so they paid for the whole wedding. You know, it's all paid for at this point. You know, everything's paid for because it's all upfront stuff. So, you know, it's all been paid for. And the average, right now, the average wedding in America, just the average, is $25,000. And so these aren't cheap affairs. And the parents of the bride, they paid the whole thing. You know, it's a big wedding. All the money's been spent. And all the presents have been given, and it's just a disaster. But, you know, my main goal was I was more concerned about the girl. Now, she was the saddest. The guy was actually relieved. She was the saddest, but I was trying to save her. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is those are two options. You know, you make a decision to marry a girl just based on pure emotion. That's not going to work out too good. You make a decision based on just pure reason. That's not going to work out too good either. And I think in our persuasion, there's emotion. We want people to make their emotions to be engaged. But there's reason, too. There's reason, too. And I would think we're better at helping them adding the emotion to it than we are at the reason. Is that accurate? That's the point I was making, Alfred. Okay. And what do you think? I'm talking about the dudes I'm talking to right here. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's generally true for most Filipinos.
Yeah.
Because like politicians, when they do the campaigns,
yeah.
I mean, they don't just show their platforms. They want to make people happy. That's why there are shows, entertainments. They invite artists,
right,
showbiz people. Why? Because they want to entertain. So they appeal on the emotion.
Yeah.
Like there's one candidate who even say, gusto ko happy ka. It means, I want you to be happy. So, I mean, the appeal to the emotion is always there. Most Filipinos are engrossed with teleseries, like telenovelas, like routinely, every day, soap operas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because
they
appeal to the emotion and all the love themes and things like that. Yeah, so I think there's some truth into it. So most Filipinos, generally...
The point I'm making, I'm trying to persuade you that we need more reason. I think that we've got the emotion part pretty good. Seems like we're pretty good at that. But I wonder how good we are at lining up truth in a way that not emotionally are they swayed, but logically, I'm convinced. I got to do what you're saying. Yeah, JR.
I think, this is just my opinion. I think it has to do something with, number one, the gifting of the preacher.
Yeah.
I am a teacher, pastor.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
So it bothers me if I myself can connect to what I'm going to teach, if it doesn't make sense to me.
Right, yeah.
That's why I really have to dig in deep, study, until it makes sense to me. I'm good at really stirring up the emotions because of my background in theater.
Yeah.
But I'm really having difficulty preaching if it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, good.
But for some people, because it's not their gift, I don't know if that's an excuse.
I'm sure they're using it as an excuse.
It's not their gift, so what connects with them?
Yeah, right.
Does it? Or again, just like what you've thought before, it's just plain laziness.
Could be.
Yeah.
Job or...
Yeah, Pastor Paul, I think this is a really great reminder for all of us because the rise of a movement that's more hinged on thinking, reason, like the Free Thinkers movement, maybe some part of it we can blame to an era of preachers. Not that we're trying to blame, but maybe the church has something to do with it because we have been focused on emotions, and now a movement is rising. is looking for reason, and we haven't addressed it for the past years. And now they're asking for answers.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to attack even the way churches are doing the emotions thing, the persuasion, on focusing on the heart matter, but not really addressing their need for reason. And so I think this is a great reminder for all of us, because rather than just complaining of a movement that's rising, we need to look into ourselves and are we doing something that's called for us to do to respond to what is rising as a movement.
Yeah, it's a great thought. Yeah, let's go here. Yeah, Earl.
In art of persuasion, you need to enter to the emotional level and then then lead them to the logical, rational thinking behind.
Yeah. Erwin?
Yeah, pretty much like this.
Yeah. Oh, just ditto. Yeah.
Because like right now we're I'm in Kirkaston City.
Yeah.
And it's mostly attended by university UP students.
Well, the best students, university students in the Philippines, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
but my point is, I think we're starting to discover that even the students, the way to their reasoning, you can only make them think once you touch their emotions first.
Yeah. My concern is that we know how to do the emotions real good. We're not as clear about how to rationally convince them. That's the point I'm going for. Yeah. Tito.
In our counseling class, we're studying about neurosciences, about the function of the brain. Okay? And part of the function of the brain, there's a seat of emotions there, which we call hypothalamus.
Yeah.
So in fact, reasoning and emotions can take place within our neural system.
Yeah.
And it's good for us as preachers to a bit have a glance or a background of the psychology of preaching.
Yeah.
That brings about good persuasion through reasoning and emotions.
Great. Wow. Profound thought. I like it, yeah. Yeah. Andrew?
Pastor Paul, I agree with the reasoning thing because I think it's related to faith. It's believing. It's how you think, and that's what you want to build in them. But I think one of the reasons why we swing to the side of emotion is because sometimes when people ask us to preach, they will say that, oh, you have to be funny, you have to have illustrations, or else they're going to zone off. Because I think sometimes the audience we're talking to, it's their wiring.
Yeah.
Sometimes, not to say that they don't think, but sometimes you have to educate them and bring them to that level of thinking. My question is, how do you impart that to your audience, bringing them to that level? This is not just about emotions, it's not about just the jokes or illustration. How do you bring them to that?
Yeah, I'm probably not the one to ask, because you guys will have to figure that out yourself. I don't know the Filipino mindset enough to know. I think you probably introduce it slowly and you lift them. You wouldn't want to change overnight. I want to comment on something JR said. I think it is true that, I don't know if it's gifting as much as the way that we're wired, which is beyond gifting, I think. I think certain people are wired to think in a more systematic way. So I find myself intuitively rearranging preachers' notes as they're preaching. My brain's just wired. I know what has to be said first, second, third, fourth. You're going to take me on a journey from where I am now, you want to get me somewhere else. In order to do it, here's the path you're going to have to take. Here's the obstacles. Here's where you're going to have to stop for a moment and camp out. And so when I hear someone, I'm automatically rearranging. Great point, but wrong time. That point should have been first. Take that point, move it back here. This point, move it around. Now you've progressed. You've taken me on a journey. So I do think some people just have a natural advantage at that. For other people, it's a little bit more difficult. But we're going to look at different ways to persuade, different ways to do reasoning. And they're not all as line upon line as that approach. There's different ways to persuade and do reasoning. And I think you just recognize that about yourself. JR, obviously you think more like I do. Seems like. Maybe not as extreme as I am. Let's hope not. But it seems like you got to get the right order and get it clear in your mind. How many think that you tend in that direction? Just like tend in the direction to think sequence like that. Yeah, okay, a few, yeah. How many think you're the exact opposite of that? Okay. The rest of you just... Yeah. Hence my point. Boom. Yeah. Yeah, Glenn.
When we do our preaching, we don't give enough time because we're saying we're presenting a reasoning or a rational argument. When we present a rational argument, when there's an argument, you allow the other party to respond.
Yeah.
So, but if we're preaching, when is the time that they will respond to our, yes, we're trying to convince, yes, we're trying to say something, but for a reasoning or an argument to be effective, you need to hear the other side. But during preaching, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, and it shouldn't.
Because I'm just thinking, Pastor Paul, during the early 80s, there are a lot of, talking about the emotional response, there were a lot of crusades where millions upon millions came to know the Lord,
yeah.
Saying in the Philippines, every other month, there are people coming in, responding to the gospel. But it's all, I would presume that it's just all an emotional response. The reasoning part were not really presented well to them. That's why after a while, when the emotions die down, then they're back to their old self. What I'm trying to say is maybe that's the reason in a way we're also effective because we come in with discipleship.
Yeah.
We come in with our one-to-one. We come in with a smaller group where we can, yes, we're preaching. Then we give them a time for them to respond in a smaller setting. Because even if we tell them all the truth, there will be some questions in their mind, and they won't have time during the preaching to respond to that. So yes, if we've appealed to the emotion, when we do the altar call, they make the decision. But at the same time, if we're able to plug them in and walk alongside them during one-to-one, then that's probably where the argument and the reasoning comes in. It becomes deeper so that they'll have a better understanding of the decisions that they've made.
Yeah. You said a lot of things, so let me make a couple comments. First of all, preaching isn't a dialogue. It's not what we're doing. We're not dialoguing. There may be some interaction, but it's not a dialogue. So when we talk about reason, it's not a discussion with people. We don't want them talking to us during the sermon. So it's more of a rational presentation. However, when we progress in this, we're going to look at the discipline of who you listen to, the discipline of who you picture as you develop your presentation. So there is a dialogical element because in your preparation, you are dialoguing with certain people, and they may be actual individuals or they may be types, right? So there's the skeptic. And in your presentation, you discipline yourself to dialogue with him. You have an imaginary dialogue. As you come up with a point, I want to make this point. And then you think, now as a skeptic, what is he going to hear? Okay, how can I reframe that to preempt his concern? But actually, in the course of preaching, you actually can introduce some elements of dialogue by after you make a point, you say, now, you're probably thinking.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I was. Mm-hmm. I know you were because I saw you. I planned for you to be here. I knew you'd be here. I knew that group, that type, and they're going to think that. Now, you're probably thinking, but doesn't this mean this? Let me explain. So I think there is an element of a dialogue that comes in, even as we're giving a rational presentation. But it happens way before we actually get there. And it's all about thinking about your audience. Because I want to persuade the audience. I want to change them. And I got to think about all the different kinds of people. How am I going to persuade them? How am I going to present truth in a way that to them is palatable and acceptable and something, I see it, I get it, and I'm buying it because it makes sense, it seems right, and I want it. If it's just reason, they'll say, I'm buying it because it makes sense. If it's just emotions, I want it. If it's both, say, I see it, it's clear, I can stand on it, and I want it. That makes sense? Great question. Yeah, Dem.
And usually I think when it comes to the listeners being moved, and most especially Filipinos, they are moved to a significant percentage or extent maybe. It's all about giving stories. Okay? So that's just my personal experience. That let's say I usually give stories.
Sure.
Okay, to drive a point. Yeah, I'm doing that. Let's say maybe you're seated right there and thinking about this one, and then I'll tell a story. And for a couple of times, sometimes so some of them, you know, they don't remember the topic maybe.
Yeah.
But they remember the story.
Sure they do.
Behind it.
Yeah.
And to think about the Lord Jesus Christ himself, he is the master of metaphors. Okay, so the Lord Jesus Christ had these parables, and we know that. And it's both a mixture of rational and emotional aspects.
But I don't want you to think that way. I want to challenge your thinking. Here's what I want you to think. I don't want you to see there's a dichotomy. There's reason over here, then there's illustrations and stories. Stories, illustrations, are a form of reason.
Okay.
There's a logic in a story. You see, it's not contrary to reason. It's one of the tools that you have in a rational persuasion. You see? And that, you know, we're going to get there. Not for a long time, apparently, but we're going to get there to that point. So, but I want you thinking the same about stories, but not like somehow now I'm not reasoning, now I'm just appealing to the emotions. Stories do both. They appeal to the emotion, but they also appeal to the reason. There's a logic in a story that is hard to deny.
Yeah, I agree, and thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, good. JR?
Regarding the invisible dialogue that's having, I really like Tim Keller when he
does
preaches.
That. Yeah.
Especially because he knew his audience very well.
I know.
Many things that he says doesn't really make sense to me because I'm not his main audience.
Right, yeah.
But I really appreciate him when he start addressing the concerns of the people. Just like what you said, well, some of you skeptics, you say this and say this.
Yeah.
And then putting myself in the shoes of the skeptics, that must be a concern for them. And then he starts addressing the liberals, etc. And I do believe that he's able to penetrate. That's why he's effective in New York.
Yeah.
Because he's able to somehow create a dialogue within his preaching that he was able to address the issues of his audience.
Yes. He calls that the discipline of who you hang out with. And I think this is huge. See, and we'll talk about this later, but it came up now, so we might as well approach it. When you prepare your materials, you never prepare it in a vacuum. Now think about this. If during the week you're preparing for a sermon, one of your close family members is in the hospital and on the edge of dying, and you're spending a lot of time in the hospital, but you're also preparing. As you read the text, you're reading the text in the light of that relative, what you can say to him, how the text, it's like whatever your people context is, it determines what stands out to you in the text. And so if you're hanging out with lost people, for example, when you're reading the text, you're reading it in the context of, gosh, that statement he made last week, and when I didn't have an answer, now I see it. So whoever you're hanging out with influences how you read the text, the things that stand out to you, how you study, and eventually those things show up in your preaching. And so we'll talk about that. I think that's a huge discipline to think about. The problem is we're hanging out for the most part with church people and maybe even the most part leaders. And so the things that we're hearing from them, we're seeing in the text, but the average person and all those different people out there, are we connecting with them? So we'll get to that in a lot more details, but yeah, go ahead, brief.
I think
we've run out of time.
What I see helpful is the preachers reading the prayer request of people. I think it's a good backgrounder for what kind of people we are preaching to.
Great, excellent. Time for a break. Let's go have some lunch.